Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 4th of September, 2013, and today we're joined on the line by Christoph Gehrmann, who people might know from his work at BoilingFrogsPost.com, where he writes a regular series called The New Great Game Roundup, where he examines the quest for power and influence and hegemony over the Central Asia and the Caucasus region by the US-NATO bloc and the Russia-China bloc, and all of the developments that are taking place there. Of course, people who are familiar with the Gladio B series that I did with Sibel Edmonds will know that this is really the ground zero for those types of operations, and is a very fascinating and increasingly important part of the global chessboard. Christoph is also available on Twitter, and he also has a blog at blogspot.com, which I will link up in the show notes for this interview, so you can go directly there. Christoph, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. I'm a big fan of your work that you're posting there at Boiling Frogs and on your blog. It's all sorts of information about the Central Asian region, which really is increasingly important. But it is our first time talking. It's the first time the audience has heard from you. So why don't we just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background and why you're interested in this region?
Yes, of course. I'm 25 years old. I'm currently studying political science in Germany, and I really got interested in geopolitics last year because of the conflict in Syria, and started using alternative media more frequently, like, for example, Land Destroyer, Tony Cataluzzi's work, of course, the Corbett Report and Boiling Frogs Post. And when you conducted your interview series with Sibel Edmonds about Gladio B in the beginning of this year, this put a lot of puzzle pieces together for me. And I started following developments in Central Asia and the Caucasus region more regularly, and started tweeting about it. And Sibel saw my tweets and contacted me, and it was basically the start of the New Great Game Roundup on Boiling Frogs Post. The New Great Game is, of course, a reference to the Great Game in the 19th century between Russian and British empires in Central Asia for supremacy in the region. And now the competition is between the United States, NATO, Russia, and China, but also other regional players. For example, Turkey plays a major role, and also the GCC petro-monarchies are involved in this as well. It's all about competition for control over resources, pipelines, tanker routes, petroleum consortiums, and the like.
It certainly is, and I hope people who have been following Boiling Frogs Post generally, or some of my conversations with Sibel, will appreciate just how important this region is to what's happening on the grand chessboard, generally speaking. But if they don't, I would suggest that they go and check out some of your work, including the Great Game Roundup series. And of course, your posts on Twitter are always very interesting and informative as well. So having established that, today we want to talk about one specific aspect of this, which is probably going to increase in importance over the next year, and that's Afghanistan, where, of course, we have been told for a long time that the NATO forces are preparing to pull out, to withdraw, after almost 12 years of invasion and occupation. Now they're preparing supposedly to withdraw their forces, and we can talk a little bit about whether we think that's really going to happen or not. But before we do that, perhaps for people who might not be as familiar with Afghanistan or what's been happening there for the last 12 years as they should be, and it has gone largely off the radar in mainstream Western political discourse, so I will forgive people out there who are not so well-versed in it, but maybe we can just establish for people out there the nature of the NATO operation there in Afghanistan and the ISAF forces. What countries are involved in this? How does the command structure for this work? Any details that you can give us about this, how this occupation has worked, and what this withdrawal or drawdown actually means?
The ISAF forces are basically led by NATO, and the United States is, of course, the major power behind it and directing the operations. And the withdrawal of the NATO troops in 2014 is often mentioned as a tipping point for the security in the region, and especially in Afghanistan. But the whole situation has actually been pretty bad in the last few years, and it's getting worse each day. Last year, there was a damning report by Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis, who was traveling around Afghanistan. And I remember Michael Hastings wrote a piece about called the Afghanistan Report, The Pentagon Doesn't Want You to Read. And Davis' assessment was essentially that the war had been a complete disaster, and the military's top brass have lied to Congress and the American public in order to cover up just how badly it's been going. We also have to remember that the goal of the troop surge in Afghanistan was to stop the momentum of the Taliban. And once it was obvious that this would completely fail, US and NATO military retroactively redefined the goals. And the new goal was to get the Afghan military prepared to take over the country. If somebody's interested in seeing how the training has actually been going, I would recommend watching the Wise documentary about it called This Is What Winning Looks Like. This Is What Winning Looks Like is referring to a speech by now retired US General John Allen, who was ISAF commander till March. And he mentioned it in one of his speeches about the Afghanistan campaign and about the success of the Afghanistan campaign, and saying, this is victory, this is what winning looks like. And the documentary clearly shows how the Afghan security forces are not prepared to take over the country. The training is a complete mess. The Afghan security forces, the ineptitude, drug abuse, and sexual misconduct, which is a nicer term for raping little Afghan boys, are rampant in the Afghan security forces, and corruption is always a huge problem. A lot of the money the United States is pouring into Afghanistan is just disappearing. And there are also problems with programs like the Afghan local police, which was established to fill the security vacuum in the short term. Afghan local police members are essentially village militias with AK-47. They have no police powers, and the accountability is a real problem. ALP units have been accused of serious crimes, including rape and murder, with apparent impunity. And the Afghan security forces are basically a complete mess and won't be able to take on the Taliban. The locals say that half of the security forces will probably just vanish when the ISAF forces leave, and the rest will probably join the Taliban. Russia and China are very concerned about the situation in Afghanistan, especially in regards to the NATO pullout. And Russian Deputy Defense Minister Anatoly Antonov recently said that the decision about the pullout had been too hasty by NATO, and that capable security forces capable of countering the radical elements had not been created yet. It's always a topic when Beijing holds talks with other countries in the region. For example, recently there had been the first official Chinese-Indian talks on Central Asia, and Afghanistan was an important topic in this as well. A spokesperson for the Chinese Foreign Ministry was recently asked about the situation in Afghanistan and about the vacuum which is supposed to happen in Afghanistan, and he said there will be no vacuum, there will be a swamp. If someone shoves his foot in there, it will be difficult to pull it out. And the Afghan government is not really a help at the moment. The President Karzai, which is basically a puppet of the United States, said that he's in no rush to sign the bilateral agreement with the United States in setting out how many U.S. troops will stay in Afghanistan, because it's obviously not a complete pullout. There will be troops left in Afghanistan. Somebody has to watch over the drug trade, I assume. And the former Supreme Allied Commander Europe, James G. Stavridis, recently argued in an article for Foreign Policy that 15,000 troops should be staying in Afghanistan, 9,000 US troops and 6,000 Allied troops. The SACEUR, Supreme Allied Commander, is really the one who's in charge of NATO. He decides about the military operation. And it's always a U.S. general who is in charge of NATO, who serves as SACEUR. The person you always see in the media, which is the Secretary General of NATO, currently Anders Fogh Rasmussen, has largely a representative function to create the impression that it's always a European who serves as Secretary General to create the impression that NATO is dominated by Europe, which it is obviously not. The situation in Afghanistan is rapidly deteriorating, and several aid groups, like, for example, the German Society for International Cooperation, warn of the security vacuum and are already affected by the withdrawal of NATO troops. The United Nations reported a rise in civilian casualties, I think about 23%, And ISAF's headquarters in Kabul receive almost daily reports about dead and wounded soldiers. While the casualty numbers declined in 2012, they have sharply risen since the beginning of this year. And we also have to remember that the Afghans are now taking more responsibility and engage more in combat with the enemy. And therefore, less ISAF soldiers should be engaged and should be dying. And the Afghans are dying as well. And actually, pretty many Afghans have died in recent months. There was a report about almost 3,000 police officers killed just in the past 4 months by the Taliban. And the Afghan Defense Ministry also came out with a statement saying that the Taliban attacks as well as the casualties of Afghan security forces have increased. And a spokesman for the Afghan Defense Ministry added that the Taliban proved by increasing their activities that the Afghan security forces are not capable of taking security responsibilities. The best example would be probably the northern province of Badakhshan in northern Afghanistan. Strategically located, it's bordering not only Tajikistan, it shares a long border with Tajikistan, but also China, in China's Xinjiang province to be exact, and Pakistan. And in Badakhshan, the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police took over from NATO, and they are completely failing the security test. The transition coincided with a spike in violence and militant activity. Due to its isolation, Badakhshan had been relatively stable for the past few years. It was so remotely located that even the Taliban weren't really interested in the province. But now we see an recent upswing in activity by militants, especially Central Asian militants and the Taliban, which are coordinating in the region now. Badakhshan is an important transit route for the opium trade. And the IMU, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, issued a new official statement in which they emphasized the group's role in fighting against the Pakistani government, but also promoted battles in Badakhshan province in northern Afghanistan alongside the Taliban. And that's a recent development we are seeing, that the Taliban are coordinating with groups like the IMU, which consists of Central Asian militants, and increase their activity in northern Afghanistan, which is not only a problem for Afghanistan, but also for the whole region, especially for neighboring Tajikistan, which has a long border with Badakhshan and which is among the weakest militaries in the region, and the border is particularly threatened. But according to some Central Asian experts, the recent spike in violence in Badakhshan is not a coincidence. We have, for example, Saifullah Safarov, who is a deputy director of a government-run Tajik think tank, coming out and saying that some countries are conspiring to merge Afghan Badakhshan, the province we were talking about, and Tajik Gorno Badakhshan, which is the province, the autonomous province of Tajikistan, which borders Afghanistan's Badakhshan. And Zafarov said they are planning to create a new state under the name of Great Badakhshan, which is probably a reference to the historic region of Badakhshan, which spread across Afghanistan and Tajikistan as we know it. And several members of the Afghan parliament have noted as well that the United States and the United Kingdom, they named the two countries in particular, are trying to establish a new independent state in this area, which this was, of course, by publications like EurasiaNet, ridiculed as conspiracy theory and was immediately dismissed. But I think it's a very likely possibility that the United States and its allies are trying to use forces in the region to destabilize the area. And Russia and China are very concerned about this because they know that these plans are ultimately aimed against them. And that's exactly what Safarov said in his statement.
Well, Christoph, you paint a very vivid picture there, and I think it's important to tease out some of the facts that we can point to that bolster that, because again, it may sound like conspiracy theory unless we look at some of the pieces of this puzzle. But you're right. I mean, the Afghan security force, so-called security force, is a shambles, and there may be concern about whether it's infiltrated by the Taliban. But I think the question might be just more: is it the Taliban itself? And we see this literally blowing up in the faces of the U.S. U.S.-led NATO troops on multiple occasions, as it turns out that some of their Afghan security force buddies actually turn out to be people who are trying to kill them. And we see this happening time and again. And then we see statements like what just recently Lieutenant General Mark Milley, who's the current ground forces commander, came out to say just the other day in Stars and Stripes. He said, quote, "We have no indication whatsoever of a withdrawal completely from Afghanistan. We are going to change our mission, and we are going to reduce in size and scope." And he went on to say, "We're only pulling out of areas where we think the Afghan security forces are capable of standing up and fighting on their own." And exactly as you indicate there, that really gives the built-in incentive. If the U.S. wants to keep themselves situated in the area, they do need that destabilization. They do need the actual blood and carnage and terror in order to justify their presence in Afghanistan. And it, as I recall, this was something that was posited by no less than Hamid Karzai himself earlier this year, who claimed that the U.S. and the Taliban were conspiring behind his back, and the U.S. was helping the Taliban to destabilize the country in order to justify their continued presence, which played well in Afghanistan. And then Kerry came in, and they kissed and made up and gave a nice press conference together. But it does add up to a picture that the U.S. and NATO generally desperately wants to maintain their presence in Afghanistan long after their mandate actually ends. So the question, I guess, is do we see, is there a way for us to come to an understanding of what particularly it is that the U.S. and NATO are so interested in Afghanistan? Is it a toehold in the region generally, or is it the specific opium production or what have you that is really the draw here?
I think that opium production is vital part of it, but I think there are also plans to destabilize certain areas, in particular in China's Xinjiang province, which is bordering Badakhshan province, and to get a foothold in this region. Xinjiang is vital for China. It's a connection point between Central and Southeast Asia, and it's also an integral part of the proposed Pakistan-China trade corridor, which runs from Gwadar, the port in Pakistan, to Xinjiang province in China. And we also had some recent reports about increased tensions between Pakistan and India at the line of control in Kashmir, which is, of course, a region where the trade corridor runs through, and it could be a threat to the future of the corridor. And I think we could see some increased militant activity in Kashmir, which is, of course, a region which was already in the 1990s very important, featured in militant activity, with persons like Osama bin Laden, for example, supporting militants in Kashmir, and also organizations like the Al-Kifa Refugee Center, if I remember correctly, were also involved in recruiting Mujahideen for the fight in Kashmir.
And of course, Kashmir. Let's be clear. Kashmir is, of course, one of the regions where it really could result in nuclear war, and it's not something that's really on the forefront of many people's minds. But it really is a high flashpoint for real military tension between two nuclear powers that doesn't get mentioned a lot in the Western media.
Yes, that's of course a huge issue. The tensions between China and Pakistan are always very important. And I think it's interesting to see how this relationship will develop. We had recent reports about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is the China-led organization, about expanding its membership and upgrading the membership of countries like India and Pakistan, also Mongolia and Afghanistan, into full members, maybe as soon as the next summit, which is next Friday in Bishkek, the Kyrgyz capital. But I'm not quite sure if these reports are accurate, especially in the light of the recent tensions between India and Pakistan. But especially Pakistan has recently emphasized its interest in joining the SCO and becoming a full member, and the relationship between China and Pakistan has improved significantly, and Pakistan has also said that it wants to cooperate with Beijing in combating terrorism, including the Turkestan Islamic Movement, which is of course the terrorist group which is advocating for the independence of East Turkestan, which is now known as Xinjiang in China. And the East Turkestan Islamic Movement operates supposedly unimpeded on Pakistani territory, for example in North Waziristan, the infamous mountainous region along the Afghan-Pakistani border, which has recently seen increased militant activity, and several militants from different Central Asian countries, Uzbeks, Tajiks, Kyrgyz, but also Uyghurs from China, who are training in the region. And there were reports coming out of Central Asia that the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan is increasing its activity there, and there have been reports about several thousand of IMU fighters which are massing in the region and are training there, but also spreading across the border into Afghanistan, which is a safe haven for the terrorists, and especially increasing their presence in the northern provinces of Afghanistan, for example, Badakhshan, but also Faryab, which is bordering Turkmenistan. So there is definitely the possibility that the region with North Waziristan and also Kashmir, but also northern Afghanistan, is becoming increasingly a terrorist safe haven, if you will, and operation space for these groups.
Now, clearly, the power block that is led by China and Russia, but includes all of their regional allies, is deeply concerned about what could happen in the event of a NATO pullout and the destabilization of Afghanistan. And clearly, they are also working on their own security coalitions that they want to include with Afghanistan. Is this being done under the auspices of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or are there other security coalitions that are working on this?
Yes, of course. The organization which is seen as the counterpart to NATO is, of course, the Collective Security Treaty Organization, which is led by Russia. And the CSTO has addressed the issue more recently, especially the strengthening of the border of Tajikistan and Afghanistan, with Secretary General Nikolai Bodyusha was in Dushanbe this week to discuss the issue with Tajikistan's President Ramon. And Bodyusha said that the CSTO will strengthen the border because the armed clashes have increased by 50%, and it's a security issue for the whole region. And Russia has especially addressed the problem and considered already deploying border guards in Tajikistan, which would of course have to be approved by the Tajik government. But also there have been some agreements already signed between Russia and Tajikistan. For example, the extension of the Russian military base on Tajikistan's territory, which was extended until 2042. And in return, Russia will provide probably between $150 and $200 million for the modernization of Tajikistan's armed forces. And President Vladimir Putin also ordered the Russian military to assist Tajikistan and help the Tajik armed forces in regards to the withdrawal of NATO troops from Afghanistan. But of course, also the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is not a military organization like the CSTO or NATO, but focuses on political and economic cooperation, has recently addressed the issue. And always when SCO meetings are held, the Chinese side tries to emphasize the fight against the three evil forces, as it's called in China, which are extremism, terrorism, and separatism. And the Chinese side tries to prioritize the issue within the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And I think it's becoming a more important issue for the other countries, which could be affected by the NATO withdrawal and increased militant activities in Afghanistan and spreading across the region.
So then, Christoph, what is your best estimate of what is actually going to happen next year? Because it seems to me that obviously there will not be a complete NATO withdrawal, but there may still be a destabilization that takes place because of a partial withdrawal, which might then justify more NATO presence in the future or something along those lines. What do you think is actually going to play out in the coming year?
There won't be a complete withdrawal, of course not. This would be a complete disaster for Afghanistan, but I think eventually the Afghan government will become less and less powerful. Basically, it's now already only powerful in Kabul, and beyond that, not really. And the Taliban will take over the short or the long term, depending on how much security forces of ISAF will stay in Afghanistan. Currently, it's being said that they will only stay and train the Afghan security forces. And I don't think that this will be enough to protect Afghanistan from the Taliban. What we are already seeing now with the increased casualty numbers across the region. But eventually, I think it could become another Taliban state, depending on how the other countries in the region, for example, China and especially Pakistan, are seeing this. Pakistan already said it supports the policy of no interference, no favorites in Afghanistan, no matter what happens after the NATO withdrawal in 2014. But we also have to see how China and Russia will react to this, because I don't think that Moscow and Beijing will be too happy if the Taliban are able to establish a state in Afghanistan, which would be a huge security threat for their borders.
Absolutely. I mean, that's an interesting test of their no interference policy, because this is one that's on their doorstep and threatens to destabilize some of their weaker parts on the Central Asian flank. So very interesting to see how that develops. And as you say, Russia is already starting to propose firming up the Tajikistan border. So we might see more of that type of activity in the coming year. And that's going to be, as I say, I think it's going to be an increasingly important part of this Central Asia piece of the chessboard. But let's expand the scope of this discussion a little bit, because you cover all of Central Asia and the Caucasus region. You cover a lot of different events that are going on. Let's talk about some of the other players that are on this chessboard and some of their motivations. And one that that we've talked about at great length with Sibel Edmonds is Turkey and its role to play. And I understand there's been some interesting documents released through Cryptome recently that brings in Yasin al-Qadi, who should be a familiar face to some of the people who have been following our conversations in the past. But let's talk about those documents that were released on Cryptome.
Of course, Yasin al-Qadi is a Saudi businessman. He was placed on a global terrorist list. He's known as a terrorist financier and for his connections to PTEC, which was, of course, famously featured in the 9/11 operation. He is alleged to have financed Osama bin Laden, Hamas, and other terrorist groups. But more importantly, he has connections to Fethullah Gülen and his backing, and with that, the current Turkish government's protection. He is a close friend of Erdogan, and Erdogan defended him even a few times and said something like, "I know Yasin, I believe in him as I do in myself." But more importantly, Yasin al-Qadi has the blessing of the United States. He and his business, they also operate in the United Kingdom with compute backing and immunity. And he also has several front businesses in Azerbaijan, which is no surprise, given he was also a frequent figure in the pre-9/11 Azerbaijan meetings, which are now infamous and which featured, among others, current al-Qaeda number one, Ayman al-Zawahiri, Yasin al-Qadi, and also Bandar Bush, along with several members of Turkey, of U.S. intelligence and military establishment. And more recently, Yasin al-Qadi was in Turkey and had several meetings with Hakan Fidan, who is the head of Turkish intelligence, MIT. They met at least five times, despite al-Qadi's restrictions of entering Turkey. And there was an interesting accident lately, which reminded me of the Susurluk accident, in which al-Qadi, one of his business associates, and Ibrahim Yildiz, the police lieutenant at the Prime Minister's Guards office, were injured and were taken to hospital. And the accident was immediately reported to Erdogan by Mustafa Latif Topaz, who is a Turkish billionaire, and close friend of Yasin Arkady, and Prime Minister Erdogan asked his son Bilan to go to the hospital and to check after Yasin Arkady. Arkady is closely with Erdogan and is financed by people like Mustafa Latif Topaz and has partnerships with other interesting people in Turkey, like, for example, the Sapsu family. The Sapsu family, with the brothers Cüneyt Sapsu and Aziz Sapsu, established, for example, the BMI United Markets chain in 1995 with Mustafa Latif Topaz and also Fatih Sarraç. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. The BMI United Markets is a dairy discounter. It's modeled after Germany's Aldi chain. Aldi is very popular in Germany. The two Aldi brothers are the two richest German people, or were the two richest German people. One recently died, and now the other brother, Karl Albrecht, is the richest person in Germany. It was very popular here and also in Turkey, and was eventually sold for $1.5 million. And Arkady was one of the major shareholders in BIM and participated also in several board meetings. The Sapsu brothers are very close to Erdogan and use their connections. Cüneyt Sapsu is, for example, Erdogan's personal aide and senior advisor. He is often referred to as the shadow foreign minister or Erdogan's right hand. And he uses his relationship to Erdogan to push through legislation which benefits him and his brother and the businesses they are associated with. The Sapsu family controls, for example, Azizler Holdings, which is one of the many large holding companies in Turkey. And there's even a nickname for the push of legislation in connection with the Sapsus called the Sapsu Law. Cüneyt Sapsu is also the vice chairman of the board of the Turkish American Business Council and the Turkish German Business Council, and also serves as senior advisor to the World Economic Forum. He's very wealthy and very well connected, and organizations like the Turkish American Business Council and Turkish German Business Council are, of course, very interesting. With the Turkish German Business Council, for example, being the equivalent to the American Turkish Council, for example, involved in all kinds of shady business, for example, drug trafficking, transferring drugs from Turkey to Belgium and the Netherlands. And we see that there's a little tight circle in Turkey of persons involved in all kinds of criminal activities, very close connected to the Turkish establishment and the Turkish government. And Yasin Arkady is, of course, one of the important figures in this, and he's also one of the interesting persons in the Azerbaijan meetings, and therefore probably one of the important Gladio B operatives, which are used by the United States and NATO for these kind of operations.
That's exactly right, and it's fascinating to watch this come together. And just for people's reference out there, the articles that we're referring to that are on Cryptome are Yasin Al-Qadi, a ban from entering country, which talks about Qadi's supposed ban from entering Turkey, but the fact that he has entered the country. And there's a related post from June 14th, Turkish traffic accident with deep connections, that goes into that accident that involved Qadi and Mr. Hakan Fidan. Absolutely fascinating. And as you say, there's obviously shades of Susurluk in this, where the Abdullah Çatlı connections to the Turkish government and the deep state were exposed. And I think this probably does have similar resonance and similar connotations. But Susurluk has become something of a scandal, a major scandal in Turkish politics. Is this accident being talked about at all in Turkey?
I haven't followed the Turkish media, but I haven't seen anything which would suggest that it's been exposed as a major scandal. There had been some reports in Turkey, I think, but nothing in English, if I remember correctly, only in Turkish.
Very interesting. Well, we'll definitely have to keep our eye on that and see what develops from it. But obviously, Yasin al-Qadi is one of those important figures that we do need to keep our eye on. As you say, has so much deep connection to Gladio B and to PTEC and 9/11 and all of these events. So very fascinating piece of the puzzle. Christoph, before we let you go today, you say that you were partly motivated to get into this because of Syria and what's happening there. So I would really like to get your take on recent developments in Syria, not only the chemical weapons attack that was alleged to take place from the Assad forces, but also the emergence of Prince Bandar on the scene and his connection to the possible false flag attack that took place there. I'd like to get your take on what's actually happening in Syria right now.
Yeah, that's very interesting, especially Bandar's reappearance after he disappeared for several time. And it was reported that he had been assassinated, probably. And then he reappeared in Moscow, meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin and basically threatening Putin, saying, if you don't change your position on Syria, you will get some problems in the Caucasus with the Chechen Mujahideen. We are the Chechen freedom fighters. We are supporting there. We are controlling there. And as Bandar predicted, when the Russians and Saudis didn't reach an agreement, the situation escalated in Syria with the chemical weapons attack, which we now know was maybe even supplied by Bandar and his Saudi minions to the rebels, the so-called rebels in Damascus, in Ghouta. And there were reports about the rebels being really angry at Bandar because they weren't instructed how to use the weapons, and then some of them exploded and they were exposed to the chemicals. Yes, I think the chemical weapons attack is probably not been deployed by the Syrian government. It wouldn't make any sense for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to use the weapons. He was winning. In fact, on a day the chemical weapons were first time reported, I think, 20th of August. There was a report in the Russian media saying that Syrian president and the Syrian government is winning the war, and it would only take 2 weeks or something in this time to basically get control over the rest of the country and push the jihadis out of the important strategic parts. And then we see the escalation with the chemical weapons attack. And now the United States preparing to launch a military campaign, completely illegal, of course, as usual. And I first thought that it would be only a small attack with a few Tomahawk cruise missiles. But now we're seeing reports that it should last about 60 days. So I'm not quite sure what kind of attack the United States have in mind, because a large attack could obviously really expand the conflict to a regional war with Iran, for example, coming out and saying that a large attack would trigger a war and would basically lead to war between Iran and Israel in the region, which would be a complete disaster for everybody involved. So I'm not quite sure how the game plan of Obama is on this. The Saudis are obviously very concerned about the whole situation, and they want regime change no matter what, because they see this struggle as existential for their own survival, probably losing their Shiite province in the east of Saudi Arabia, which would mean they lose large numbers of their oil supplies. So I think that Saudi Arabia will continue to push for regime change no matter what. But we have to see how the United States will go about their military action, and what kind of action this will be, and how the Syrian government and its allies, especially Iran and Hezbollah, will respond to this. Russian President Putin said today that he strongly opposes military action, and he wants to see evidence before the United Nations Security Council. And he doesn't believe that the Syrian government was responsible for the attack, but the rebels were probably responsible, because they had everything to gain from the attack and Assad had nothing to gain from it.
Exactly. And the parallels between what happened recently and what happened back in March with the attack on Khan al-Asl is there. And of course, in that case, they spent months going through the evidence and presenting a report and presenting it to the UN, and versus this, where basically the US came out before the inspectors had even visited the site to say Assad was to blame and they had to start bombing. So it's quite transparent, I think, that this is just a convenient casus belli. But this is, I mean, what a fascinating situation with Prince Bandar, and we'll have to see, I guess, if he makes good on his threats to Putin regarding the Chechen terrorists. But at any rate, just a really interesting situation, but of course one that really is of great concern, especially if this does turn into a protracted battle, which could then lead to a larger regional conflict. So very, very important things that are happening right now in Syria. And as you say, I think we'll have to see how this plays out. But the surprising thing so far has been that the headlong rush to war has not happened so far. I mean, we saw the British Parliament kick back against David Cameron, and we've seen some resistance in the US that has actually led Obama to back down and tuck tail between his legs and go to Congress to ask for approval. So we have seen some significant setbacks to this headlong rush to war. How about the general media there in Europe, in Germany specifically? How are they treating this, and how is this being portrayed?
The media in Germany is basically directed from Washington, as is the politics of the German government. We are very much influenced by what's happening in the United States, and the media is reporting always with a very strong spin on the issue, and always reporting in the like the United States would want to have it reported in Europe. And so the public opinion is always being influenced against Russia, for example, against China, against Syria, and always for the United States. No matter how bad the situation looks, and no matter how clear the evidence is, but there has been some awakening, I think, with alternative media gaining ground, and establishment media losing their credibility more and more each day.
Excellent. Well, all part of that global political awakening, which Brzezinski fears so much, but which is taking place, and is taking place because of the work of people like yourself and the excellent work you're doing with the new Great Game Roundup at BoilingFrogsPost.com. So I hope people will check that out. Again, the links to your blog and to your Twitter will be in the links for the show notes of this interview, so people can start following your work, and I hope they do so. Christoph, a fascinating conversation, and there's much, much, much more to talk about, but I think we'll have to leave that for another day. So I think we'll wrap things up there, but thank you very much for your time today, and I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.